The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
One other stock we're watching today is Home Depot. It's off by about 1.5%. The company said it's going to buy building products distributor SRS Distribution, a roofing company, for about $18.25 billion. So want to get more on that. And who do we go to? The best guy in the housing industry when it comes to analysts. Drew Redding is Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. home building analyst joining us. All right, what do you make of the acquisition and the fact the stock's down?
Yeah, so this deal, $18.25 billion, is Home Depot's largest ever acquisition. Prior to this one, its largest deal was the $8 billion deal it did for HD Supply back in 2020. SRS did about $10 billion of revenue. So for a company as big as Home Depot, this is actually a pretty big deal. And we think it fits with their strategic plan of going after that professional customer. It's a very highly fragmented market. You know, our view has been that if they really want to accelerate their growth, particularly in this segment of the market, they would probably have to do a couple of deals. They did a deal, the one I mentioned, HD Supply, back in 2020. They recently did a deal for International Designs Group, and now they added on with this one. You mentioned the stock is down. You know, as I mentioned, it's a pretty big deal. And I think the fact that people are still kind of hoping and waiting for that the underlying housing market to kind of return to growth. And that's really the primary driver of Home Depot's business. I think the fact that you're layering this on top of, you know, those market expectations may be weighing a little bit.
I see.
I'm looking at the structure of the deal. First, I go to MA Go, which is the first thing I do for an M&A story, and to see who the bankers and lawyers are, and MA Go does not have that information. I'm very disappointed.
Aww.
So I have to talk to the MA people. Maybe it hasn't been disclosed. They're going to go to the debt markets here. They do have a little bit of cash on the balance sheet here, but they're going to finance it with some debt. Is that okay with you and the credit analysts out there?
Yeah, so their leverage is going to tick up debt to EBITDA about 2.5 times. The goal going forward is to deleverage over the next 24 months to get back to a kind of 2 times target. So it's not that much of a concern at this point. You know, in order to do that, the goal is obviously to accelerate growth, but at the same time, they're going to put their share repurchases on hold in order to get that leverage back down in a timely fashion.
Okay, well, there you go. That's why the stock's down. This is why I love anchoring with Paul, because it's like two different perspectives. I'm like, what's the macro read? And you're like, let's talk about how they're paying for it. This is perfect. This is why Paul Sweeney is so awesome. But to the point of like the why, this is not like John Tucker renovating a closet to a bathroom, right? Like, it's not that. Like, these are the real people.
Yeah, these are the professional remodelers. So SRS caters to specialty trade contractors. So think building materials, primarily roofing, as well as landscape and pool. So building materials are about 2/3 of their business, and the pool and landscape pieces are about a third. Those are actually newer markets that they entered in through M&A. So Home Depot's main strategy is going after an untapped $200 billion market for what they call complex projects. And if you think about a professional contractor who is typically juggling, you know, a handful of supplier relationships for a larger scale job, they might have to go to one distributor for windows. They might have to go somewhere else for flooring, somewhere else for doors, yeah, and so on and so forth. And so Home Depot's goal and their strategy is to kind of consolidate the need for contractors to go to all those different suppliers. You want to become a one-stop shop.
Talk to me about just kind of the economics of that business. Like, what's the, is there a difference between selling a piece of plywood to the John Tuckers of the world versus selling a piece of plywood to, you know, a local contractor?
Well, professional contractors are typically higher spending. And you see that if you look at the store productivity of a Home Depot compared to Lowe's after the last several years, you see that the sales per square foot, sales per store, highly much stronger for Home Depot. And a lot of that has to do with the spending nature of that professional contractor.
I see. Okay. I mean, just look at John Tucker. Like, he's definitely not going to be spending that high. He's not going to the high-end place in Home Depot.
But he does high-quality work, though, I'm sure.
Oh, no. Totally into the high-quality work, 100%. So it sounds like you think this deal makes sense. Where does it put it then in relation to Lowe's, which I must assume has to be trying to carve out its own niche in that?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And the strategy, you know, in attacking the pro segment between Home Depot and Lowe's is a little bit different. As I mentioned, Home Depot is targeting kind of that larger pro, whereas Lowe's is kind of focusing on that small and medium-sized contractor. And this is kind of an area they've been emphasizing over the last couple of years, because prior to 2018, when the new CEO, Marvin Ellison, came in, Lowe's didn't really have a dedicated pro strategy. It was kind of all over the place. So their you know, philosophy has, let's get back to the fundamentals of the business. Let's have the right brands. Let's make sure we have things in stock. Let's make sure we have the proper quantities and the right staffing. So they're kind of coming from a different position where they're getting back to basics, where Home Depot already has that dominant position and they're looking to expand into an untapped market.
All right, let's step back, Drew. Talk to us about what's going on in the housing market. What's the elevator pitch you're giving to clients these days? How are investors approaching the housing market? Because I don't see a lot of houses for sale, dude.
Yeah, so, I mean, we've talked before, the way we describe housing as a tale of two markets. We still think that the new home market is in the driver's seat, both from a supply perspective and from an affordability perspective. The most important thing to remember is that builders are growing their community counts. They're bringing new products to market. And unlike what you see in the resale market, they're making financing more attractive. So they're buying down rates. So right now, if you look out there in the market, you're seeing something, you know, in the 6.97% range on a 30-year fixed. You know, if you go to the new home market, you're seeing something much lower. You probably have a 5 handle. So the math looks a lot better in the new home market. Interestingly, more recently, we have started to see a little bit more inventory come to the market in the resale side, you know, which you mentioned has been kind of the major theme permeating throughout the industry. So we could see that start to help volumes. We think that the resale market starts to rebound later in this year and maybe sees a little bit of modest growth.
I have a really dumb question. If I want to sell my apartment and I have a 2.75% 30-year fix, can I sell that rate along with the apartment?
No.
It's a hard no.
It's a hard no.
The buyer in your market is going to be coming with something significantly higher. Now, there are ways where, you know, through various concessions, a seller can help a buyer kind of lower that rate. You know, if the buyer were to pay points and then, you know, the seller can contribute to closing costs, that's one way to do it. But, you know, as you mentioned, that's one of that's the primary reason why people aren't putting their homes on the market. And it's also what's keeping people from making purchases.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, that's a very clear. Also, why would I do that?
Yeah. I'm not forever.
No, I'm there forever. I'm for sure. This was not like a promo. Like, unless I win the lottery.
Yeah. You guys are there
no
forever,
way.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Because that interest rate is just unbelievable.
It's unreal. It's also a condo. Yeah. So then you can always rent it out, like if I move somewhere else or whatever. Like from that perspective. Even a co-op, though, I wouldn't in a million years. Hey, Drew, thanks a lot. Really appreciate Drew Redding, Bloomberg Intelligence, U.S. home building analyst. And just so you're all clear, that is a 2.75% 30-year fix that I got in 2020. Just putting that out there.
That is awesome.
I feel like it's important
to keep
saying.
Me, on the other hand, in 2023, March of 2023, even 6%.
But that now feels good.
Yeah, like I felt like a complete knucklehead at the time. Like, oh, you're supposed to be a Wall Street guy and you're just paying through the nose here on the rates. But boy, then they went up to 7.
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
I have a friend who's trying to buy a house, first home buyer, like, you know, ground up, like 30 years old kind of thing. And it's really hard.
Tough,
like, it's really tough. And it's like, when do you do that? The prices haven't really matched up with those higher rates. So anyway, there we go. I'm glad we got that all out of the way.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, to the markets we go. We're seeing a little bit of a sell-off in the front-end yields, up just a touch, despite some pretty hawkish-ish messaging coming out from Chris Waller yesterday evening, where it seemed like it was, we're going to be waiting. We're going to be waiting and waiting and waiting. Ira Jersey is Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Interest Rate Strategist joining us now. Ira, I'll read you the quote. In my view, it is appropriate to reduce the overall number of rate cuts or push them further into the future in response to the recent data. There's still no rush. These were two remarks to the Economic Club of New York as of yesterday. What does that tell us?
Yeah, well, it's a continuation of what some of the more hawkish members of the Federal Reserve have been saying. You know, we think that Governor Waller probably is in the two cut this year camp. So, you know, there's when you look at the dot plot, and we only received it, you know, last week. So so it's very fresh. We think that he's one of the people in the two cut camp. So but so that means that he's maybe kind of the spokesperson for the more hawkish members of the committee, whereas, you know, it's still a bulk of the committee is in the three cut camp. I think the important thing about Governor Waller's comments is, you know, you can't be assured of a June cut at the moment. Like, in order to get a June cut, you need to probably have a continuation of slowing economic activity and certainly a decline in inflation. And you know, we put out a piece just this morning saying, look, if we keep getting, you know, 0.2 inflation prints for the next couple of months, that's not going to lower the year-on-year inflation number at all. So, yeah, you know, so it's unclear to us whether or not, you know, June or July or even maybe the Fed might have to wait till November. And that's where you can get a lot of market pricing shifts if we don't price in for a June or July cut anymore and we wind up pushing things out even further.
So, Ira, tomorrow, I'm not going to be here. Markets are going to be equity markets are going to be closed here. Yeah, we're getting
bond market's closed too there, Paul.
What's that?
Bond market is closed too.
Okay, I don't want to speak for the bond market people. You guys have your own little club over there. PCE deflator. We're going to get some meaningful information tomorrow. Odd timing aside, how do you think the Fed's thinking about the data tomorrow? The PCE deflator, the core deflator, is expected to come in at 0.3%.
Yeah, so 0.3 is a continuation of the trend. And yeah, you know, given that we have CPI, I think that PCE will kind of take a little bit of a backseat to some of the other details that we're going to parse through, particularly since the market's closed. So there won't be the same kind of knee-jerk reaction you might get in the U.S. markets anyway. Europe will still be open, parts of Europe will still be open. So that'll be interesting to see how they react. And that'll give you a clue as to how we'll open up at 7 p.m. on Sunday night in the Treasury market. You know, what I'll be looking for in these numbers is a continuation of the actual consumption trends. Because remember, even though we get that very important PCE deflator, so the inflation component of the PCE report, you also get personal consumption numbers. So actually what people are spending their money on, how things are growing. And what I like to look at is what's called the quantity indices. So these are basically real spending and how those are developing. And what you've seen of late is that even though you've had a little bit of a leveling off in people spending on durable goods, the amount of money that people are spending on services continues to go up. And you even saw that today in the GDP report. All of the revisions of the fourth quarter GDP came because of higher consumption of services, and that was revised higher. And as long as services continue to be a big focus and people are content to continue to spend on services, there's a feedback loop, because that's where most of the people in the United States are employed. So as long as people are spending on services, that means that services are going to be making money and that people can request wage increases. Those wage increases then can go back and be spent again on services, right? So I think that those are the kinds of numbers and some of the detail that I think will be important as to whether or not you know, the economy is really going to be starting to slow, and if that will feed into then lower inflation. Because even in the inflation components, what we'll be looking for is how much is services inflation versus goods inflation. Goods inflation has been zero basically for the last 6 months, and it's all of the inflation has really been coming from the services sector. So that has to be everyone's focus right now.
Oh, sorry. It's that pesky button where I press off, but I mean on. And anyway, I wish my husband probably wishes he had that button. But anyway, what I was saying is that goods inflation too, the disinflation narrative around that is also coming into question potentially when you have the Baltimore Bridge collapse, etc. Ira, you're still at 2. Is the risk that you actually pare that down to 1 or 0, or is the risk that it's actually 3?
Yeah, I think the market's still priced for 3 cuts this year. Now, you know, we were pricing just 2 months ago 6 cuts, right? 650 basis points of interest rate cuts. Yeah, I think the risk is that the Fed starts a little bit later, but the path looks very similar to what's being priced right now. So it's more that things get pushed forward and forward and forward. And keep in mind, you know, the market will often price for outcomes that aren't going to be realized. And that's where, you know, we try. That's where strategists and portfolio managers can kind of, you know, make their living in trying to determine what's kind of mispriced and what are the highest probability outcomes. Yeah, you know, interestingly, you know, to your point, you know, there is a risk that there's actually no cuts this year, and the market is actually pricing for upwards of a 20% chance of that. If you look at options on short-term interest rate futures, like the futures on SOFR, so our options model suggests that you know, there's a pretty high possibility being priced that, you know, the Fed's on hold. And you even saw some activity this morning. You know, Ed Bullenbrook, who does a really good job with looking at flows in the short-term interest rate markets for Bloomberg News, he even noted this morning that there were people buying puts on these futures that suggest that the Fed might not actually cut at all this year. So I think that there is a growing kind of community out there that's fearful that the economy won't slow down enough for the Fed to actually cut.
All right, we'll see. Ira Jersey, thank you so much. We appreciate that. As always, Ira Jersey, he's the chief of his interest rate strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from Princeton, New Jersey via that Zoom thing.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
So let's get back to what Governor Waller talked about. And that was basically like, we're just not there yet. Let's wait, let's wait, let's wait. And then it's raising the risk of maybe no cuts this year, which leads me to the market reaction. The overwhelming idea in the first quarter was that you're going to have bonds outperform stocks because we were going to get cuts. That obviously didn't work out for you. So what do you do for the second quarter? Joining us now is David Kudla. He's founder, CEO, and chief investment strategist over at Mainstay Capital Management. And he joins us now. David, is this going to be another quarter of stocks outperforming bonds?
I think it will be. I think that stocks are in rally mode. We're almost in a melt-up situation. The increase we've had in 2024 alone, the increase we've had now over the past 5 months has just been incredible. And the problem for bonds is that we keep, you know, we've talked about 6 or 7 Fed rate cuts just a few months ago. We're down to 2 or 3, maybe 1. They're getting moved out. They were March, got moved out to June, moving out as far as September. We may not see a rate cut this year. So that's problematic for bonds, obviously. And we've seen what the 10-year and the rest of bonds have done because of that. What we've done, where you do have opportunity in bonds, though, for your portfolio, for someone in a 60-40 portfolio, they need that bond allocation, stay ultra short on ultra short-term bonds, so you have very little duration, very little interest rate sensitivity. But we have these high yields we're still getting with rates being this high. So that is an attractive part of the yield curve for a bond allocation. But, you know, stocks, I think, continue to be on roll. We are due for a pullback at any time here of 4 or 5%. We've gone so long without as much as a 2% pullback in a day and any meaningful pullback. But, you know, we're still very constructive on stocks and constructive relative to bonds.
So, David, where are we in terms of valuation here? How do you think about the valuations in the equity markets if, you know, maybe we're in this melt-up kind of mode?
Yeah, so we're getting a little rich. We're at 20.9 is, let's call it 21, forward priced earnings on the S&P 500. The 5-year average is around 19. So we're a little bit rich, not as rich as we've seen in the past. And, you know, there's a lot of people referring to this as a bubble. And I think that people that think we're in a bubble for stocks haven't studied a lot of bubbles to know, you know, what that really means. When we look at the fundamentals, you know, we have some of these growth stocks and the mega tech stocks trading at higher PEs in the 20s and 30s, but they deserve it, right? And so, you know, we think that we can still, and you never want to make a market call based on valuation, right? Stocks can stay undervalued or overvalued for a very, very long time. So while they're starting to get a little bit stretched, that's not a big concern for us because I think the fundamentals are still there to support it.
So based on that, though, I guess, because you're right, like it can always still go higher, even if it's overvalued, right? For the equity market, mm-hmm. for example. But do you need to also rotate? So maybe you're not going to sell the Mag 7, for example, or sell NVIDIA, but do you need to rotate into more cyclicals? And like what does that wind up looking like?
Right. So, you know, what we favor right now, our overall investment strategy can be summed up very easy. Large over small, growth over value, the U.S. over foreign. Outside of the U.S., we also like Japan. But the key here in diversification is, you know, we're seeing industrials, financials, some of the other areas starting to perform better. We're seeing more breadth in the market, but we would stay with mega cap tech, the power of generative AI. They just announced healthcare assistants, basically, that do the work of a nurse. You know, it's going to enter so much of our lives in the professional workplace, be transformational. So we've narrowed our Magnificent Seven down to our own Fab Four. We took out Apple, Google, and Tesla, that Fabulous Four is up 38% this year. And, you know, really it's become, you know, surprisingly enough, somewhat of a safety trade to go to these stocks when rates are going higher. They don't care about interest rates. They have plenty of free cash flow to fund operations and their research and development. So it remains to be a good core of the portfolio, but there's some other places you can look out. We'd avoid small caps until we know rates are coming down, also with cyclicals. Mid caps, though, we've increased our exposure to, is an area, you know, the in-betweeners that they've grown out of the small cap camp, not the large cap yet, but mid caps have also started to shine as well.
Other sectors, David, besides some of those technology names, we've heard some folks talk about healthcare, some folks talk about financials. Either of those get your attention?
Yeah, financials, healthcare, industrials. especially we think it makes sense to, you know, we want to have a diversified portfolio. We are overweight tech. It's our highest weighting by far, or IT and communications. But we do think that as rates start to come down, you know, when the yield curve finally gets back to looking like something normal, that will be very helpful for financials. And you know, we'll see industrials kind of do well. When we look towards this year, we're not looking for recession, you know, and we think we could have a soft landing, but we think it's more about a no landing. It's more that we'll have a slowdown and reaccelerate. We've got GDP was just revised for the fourth quarter to 3.4%. Economy strong, mm-hmm. Labor remains strong. There's some indicators out there with, you know, the level of bankruptcies, credit card debt, credit card interest rates, what's happening in housing. There's some worrisome areas, but the economy just keeps chugging along.
David, wouldn't that scenario though be good for industrials, materials, energy, like those sectors?
Yeah. And we're seeing there's some other reasons in energy. There always are. You know, geopolitical risk premium and so forth. We've seen what oil's been doing. We've seen what cocoa's been doing. I think
it's
everybody's
high.
Having
it's very
a lot
high.
Of fun.
Yes.
It's very expensive.
Yeah, everybody having a lot of fun with that one. Maybe needing to avoid as much, maybe not the chocolate Easter egg this year, but you know, there are commodities doing better. And actually, you know, the cocoa story is just incredible. But we think that, materials with a more normal yield curve, financials, healthcare, certainly, that's a large sector for us as well.
All right, David, thank you so much for joining us. David Kudla, he's the founder, chief executive officer, and chief investment officer for Mainstay Capital Management. Troy, Michigan is where he hails from, so we got him via Zoom there.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A good little M&A trade more than me. And that's what Amazon's up to. They invested $2.75 billion in AI startup Anthropic. So when we talk about Amazon, one of the voices we have to get on board is Anurag Rana, senior technology analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Anurag, tell us about Anthropic. What is Anthropic, and why is Amazon investing another $2.75 billion into this company?
Paul. So think of Anthropic as very similar to OpenAI. It's a company that develops its large language models that people can use to do, you know, whatever AI-related chatbots and other kind of analysis that they want to do. Now, the thing is, as you know, OpenAI, when Microsoft invested in them, OpenAI runs on Microsoft's cloud. And this is what Amazon wants. It wants Anthropic's, you know, core business to run on their cloud. People go out and experiment with them. You know, that's kind of feeds into their cloud business.
How much have they now spent on AI cloud stuff?
On Amazon?
Yeah.
See, one of the things is this is just a, you know, few billion dollars over here. But I would argue that the base that they are doing, or the base architecture or the base infrastructure that they have on cloud, you know, they've spent over $100 billion over it, you know, the last 10, 15 years. So this is a big enough number, because you can't run a lot of these models without being on cloud. Now, that's not truly true. There are, you can run it on premise on the device also, but a large portion of the processing will be done on the cloud.
Just to follow on that, how does that compare to its other competitors in the biz?
One of the things I would say is, you know, Microsoft, I don't think they got lucky. They really knew what they were investing in when it went to OpenAI. OpenAI came up with its product far sooner than anybody else, and that's why all of us talk about it. But companies like Anthropic, I think it's, you know, I won't call them behind, but I'm sure that their models are going to be used by other people also.
Yeah, that's what I'm seeing in some of the reporting here. Anthropic, so this isn't exclusive to Amazon. I mean, it seems like Anthropic has, you know, tie-ups with Google as well, Spark, and some others. So what's really the strategic value for Amazon here?
I think they call themselves their preferred cloud vendor. And again, for Amazon's point of view, what they're doing is they're giving people a laundry list of multiple models they can use. They can use Amazon's own model. They can actually use Meta's model called Llama, or they can use Anthropic and a couple others. So, you know, if I'm an enterprise, if I'm a big, large bank and I want to experiment with them, it's my choice what I want to use over there. And that's really what Amazon's selling.
See, this is where Anurag and I and our worlds can collide. Power.
Oh, here we go. Here I saw we that go. Coming.
Yeah, I was like,
you
how?
Waited the proper amount
Did
of time.
Did I? Yes. I thought I should have waited for like a couple more minutes, but I just had to go there. We can always go back. It's cool. So Anurag, well, I was just down in Texas for CERAWeek, which is like energy's big Super Bowl, and the only conversation everyone was having was about power and power demand skyrocketing due to data centers and AI, et cetera, and that Amazon had bought a nuclear power reactor center in order to power one of their data centers. Can you just talk me through, the more they invest in AI and stuff, does that just mean they have to just go buy more power plants?
Yeah, if you look at capital expenditures for Microsoft and Amazon, it's really ballooning up right now. I mean, one's trying to spend, I think, $40+ billion a year into expanding a lot of their data center capacity. Now, you could say that, oh, that's going to take out a lot of operational cash flow or help bend margins maybe in the near term. But I would argue that their business is becoming stronger by the day because nobody else can replicate this stuff. I mean, it's not easy to come up with these many billions of dollars to come up with their data centers. And in fact, I would say that companies that have their own data centers may be forced to close out and move a lot more stuff to the cloud because these guys have so much firepower with them.
Oh, interesting.
Hey, Anurag, I know the company here, Anthropic, offers a chatbot named Claude, but the companies
want a chatbot named Claude.
Yeah, exactly. But they're kind of emphasizing developing AI safely and responsibly. Where are we on that whole concept of safety and responsibility for a technology that most of us really don't fully grasp?
It's like when a company's like, I want to be profitable. It's like, well, I hope
yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Paul and Alex, I'm still waiting for that in the social media applications.
Yep.
So I do not know how that's going to shape up. But one of the things that we have seen with Claude is they are marketing themselves as being better than OpenAI in certain aspects. I think that's, again, that's the company saying, so please, take that into account, that a lot of their experiments have said that Claude's better at certain things than OpenAI is.
So, I mean, what's the next thing for Amazon? I'm just wondering if there's not much to go out there and buy to automatically give you AI
scale,
critical mass,
scale.
Even if you're Amazon, you can't just write a check like you can in Hollywood, for example, if you want to get into that business. Is this just the
That's
tech industry just, I guess, putting their R&D, putting their CapEx, putting their funding to all things AI going forward?
Yeah, I absolutely say that. Now, think about it this way. Currently, what's happening is Microsoft is reaping the benefits of you and I using ChatGPT more. So if we do more processing, Microsoft gets the benefits of it. Now, what Amazon is saying that, listen, that's one way to make money in AI. How about I do this? I'll give you all the raw materials for you to go out and build your own chatbot internally, let's say for a bank or for a beverage company. If you want to do that, then come to my cloud. I have all the raw material for you. I have all the models, and I will do it safely for you. And that's Amazon's pitch, which means that the revenue fall through may be a little bit longer than what we are seeing at Microsoft.
And then do we know how sticky those customers are? Like if Amazon's like, hey, I'll do all this stuff for you, and I'm like, cool, and I stay there? Or is it, I guess I'm getting at, is there a first mover advantage to that?
Yeah, from a logical point of view, once you choose a cloud vendor to do any kind of process, it could be just your back office work, and it's very difficult for you to get rid of that, and that's the whole point of cloud. So what essentially both of them are selling, not so much an AI, but they're basically selling, just come to my cloud and start using it, because once you start using it, you're not going to go anywhere else.
Does Apple have an AI strategy?
Well, we'll find out on WWDC, I believe, in June, that they're going to go out and basically, put the AI into Apple. But that's going to be fun to see what happens over there. The initial response, or at least discussions that we are seeing, is that they're going to try to outsource that a little bit to Google. And if they do, I think their reception is going to be very strong. If they basically say, we're going to just do it in-house, then we don't know how long it's going to take for those products to really evolve. So I think that is one of the pivotal moments for Apple as it relates to their sales and profit growth over the next 12 to 24 months.
Can I go to this conference, or do you have to be like invite only?
I think it's invite only. I've been
sorry,
it's
Paul. Very yeah, I'm not gonna make that list. I think you could make it. You know everybody. He knows all the people. Anurag, I'm looking at Amazon stock at 181.21. Do you feel like all? I know that their cloud business might be different, but the AI part of all of this, do you feel like it's accurately priced, or how do you model it?
It's very difficult to price any of the AI related revenue because at the end of the day, it all goes to the cloud. So, I mean, that's how what we want to see. Mm. Having said that, as I said, it's going to take a little bit longer for Amazon to monetize a lot of these things. So we are not building in any kind of our projections looking into, you know, when they report earnings next month. We think it's going to be still about, you know, 6 to 12 months out. But for Microsoft, because it's a direct, you know, usage of ChatGPT, I think they're going to get, a bigger boost than anybody else at this point.
All right, Anurag Rana, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Anurag Rana, Senior Technology Analyst, Bloomberg Intelligence, phoning it in, zooming it in from somewhere. Looking at Amazon.com, stock's up 19% today. 19% year to date. All-time high for this name. I love putting up the long-term chart, like from the beginning of time.
Because
remember, this stock was nowhere for a while because they were losing money hand over fist. And then at some point, Jeff Bezos got the street to just switch it on a dime and say, don't worry about profits. We're investing in the future, and our future is great. You want us investing in the future. You don't want us delivering EPS to you. For years and years and years, that didn't work. And then we hit an inflection, and boom. Because I think people realized, this thing, you can sell more than just books on this thing.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Now I understand.
You're just not a Barnes & Noble competitor anymore.
Exactly.
You're something else. But, you know, that's such a great point, because I feel like when we talk to any company about, look at our new AI offering, look at this cool partnership we have with Microsoft, look at what we're doing with Amazon. It's really hard for lay people like me to understand what that means.
Yep.
Like, is this a tangible thing? Is it just, you know, a sexy bell and whistle that's not going to actually do anything materially for you?
Yep.
And it's hard to kind of weed through all the stuff, to be honest, which is why I guess it's good we have Anurag and stuff.
Exactly. I mean, for me, AI, to me, is what's incremental on the CapEx spend that everybody talks about over the next 5 years, and what is just more just repositioning some other CapEx spending. That's kind of for me.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Max Chafkin joins us. He's a Bloomberg Businessweek senior reporter. He's got his piece entitled Bankman-Fried's Original Sin at FTX is trouble for all of crypto. Max, thanks so much for joining us here. Really appreciate you taking the time here. I think at the crypto industry, if you think about it, as a broad entity, they'd like to put all this behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you look at who has been most sort of most vociferous in calling out Sam Bankman-Fried, you sort of have two groups. One are some crypto critics, but actually a lot of the crypto companies themselves, because the idea here is this guy is a bad apple. We got to get him out. We got to excise him from the industry, which is understandable. But as we write in the story, you know, there's some problems with that. And the main problem is that a lot of the conditions that made FTX possible continue, and the crypto industry is essentially trying to deregulate the industry further. So sort of responding to this crisis by saying we need fewer rules, not more.
Would that have made a difference?
If there were more rules? Yeah, of course.
But how? Because he was actively lobbying sort of Congress to do stuff. Like, he wanted that. So doesn't that fly in the face of, if more rules, he wouldn't have been able to do what he did?
So this is like a sort of common misunderstanding, I think. I mean, just because he's lobbying for Congress doesn't mean that he's wanting to be regulated. He was lobbying for rules that would have been, you know, conducive to what he wanted to do. I mean, the central thing is FTX was operating offshore, quote unquote, operating in the Bahamas, officially not selling products to Americans, although we know from what's happened since that Americans were finding their way into some of these banned products. A lot of these crypto companies have been wanting to bring that model to the United States. Like, that's the big thing. That is what Sam Bankman-Fried was trying to do and what many in crypto essentially still want to do.
Are there people, is it a fair criticism of the industry or maybe some of the leading people in the crypto industry that the industry itself and some of the leaders enabled Sam Bankman-Fried along the way, and that simply trying to wash your hands of it at this point is, you know, disingenuous?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, FTX was entirely enmeshed in the industry, investing in many of the companies, you know, during the sort of collapse of the crypto markets in 2022, bailed out many of the companies. You know, remember all these headlines around describing Sam Bankman-Fried as the, you know, as the savior of the crypto industry, as the Warren Buffett of crypto, as the next Warren Buffett. And those all came because this was a company that was putting huge sums of money into all these other companies. And it's the reason why the markets crashed further in the weeks and months after the FTX bankruptcy. So yes, absolutely. Although, of course, that's like a somewhat awkward question. And also, there have been differences in approach. It's not like all of the companies are operating in the exact same way. I think Coinbase has legitimately made more of an effort on the regulatory front than, say, FTX. But Coinbase is also trying to deregulate in various ways.
What about the recovery? So I feel like a lot of this is spent on, you know, Bernie Madoff's victims, for example, didn't get anything back. And therefore, if Sam Bankman-Fried's victims got some back, then that should reduce his jail time. Talk us through that.
So, in fact, Bernie Madoff's victims have gotten money back. So 90%.
Okay,
so this initially, of course, they lost all their money. But in the years since, and it's, you know, many years now, 90% of the initial investment from the Madoff victims has been recovered. Now, that doesn't, like, the Madoff victims are still very unhappy. And even if they get to 100%, still going to be very unhappy because not having access to your money for years. Yeah. Or even decades.
And not even knowing it, that's going to happen.
Yeah, and they're huge. Mm-hmm. And as many of the victims have pointed out in this case, getting 100% of your assets back at the time of bankruptcy years later is still difficult. People have suffered extreme emotional distress. Like, you know, their lives have essentially been ruined. So there's that point. But then there's the legal matter, which is it doesn't matter. And the judge brought this up in the proceeding today. You know, if you squander, if you steal customer money and take it to put it in your pocket, walk into a Vegas casino, and then later pay them, you know, somebody else comes along and pays them off, that doesn't change the legal situation. So there's a moral question of like, well, what does it mean if they've been able to recover their money? And then there's the legal one. For the legal one, it doesn't matter.
And I'm just, you know, reading your story here. Unfortunately, the conditions that allowed people to fall for schemes such as Bankman-Fried's, a lot of those conditions still remain here. And where are we in just terms of the regulatory framework? Is there any agreement maybe how this should evolve over time?
No. I mean, we have seen certain, I don't know if you want to call it progress. I mean, of course, there are, like, the SEC approved certain spot Bitcoin ETFs. There's now a big debate, you know, within the industry, should they allow for other spot ETFs, say Ethereum or other assets that are maybe not as well established as Bitcoin. The SEC, Gary Gensler, has been pretty cool to that possibility. You know, the industry, you know, backing up, There's a ton of money coming in here. Yep. Crypto prices are soaring. A lot of the same kind of frothy enthusiasm that we saw in the pre-FTX collapse, it's there. You know, and in certain ways, it's worse, right? But during the FTX buildup, we were talking about all the wonderful use cases for crypto. Blockchain was going to change everything. And when you actually listen to what people in the crypto industry are talking about lately, they're just more talking about the numbers going up and the fact that, yeah, you have new money coming in through these ETFs, and we're seeing all of these tokens, some tokens where really there's nothing going on besides vibes, you know, these quote-unquote meme coins that are also soaring. And in fact, many of the tokens that have gone up the most are the same tokens that were going up during the FTX run-up. So I think there is certainly, when you're talking about huge amounts of speculation, there is going to be pain ahead for some of the speculators. Of course, there's also the potential for ever more wealth. So so that's the tension.
Before I let you go, we have like a minute left. We have later on TV William Quigley, who's the co-founder of Tether. What's my question for him?
I mean, I think the Tether situation, one of the things that's craziest about this, if you went back 10 years ago, or 5 years ago and asked, you know, which company is most likely to run into issues, regulatory issues and so on, people, you know, Tether was one that crypto skeptics have brought up over and over again over the years, and they have managed to stick it out and are still here at a time when, you know, the CEO of Binance is headed for prison, you know, the former CEO of FTX, former CEO of Binance, former CEO of FTX also appears to be headed to prison. So that's impressive. I do wonder how Tether tries to adjust further, or if they have plans to adjust further, right? For years, people have wanted to see more information about what's on their balance sheets, and they've essentially resisted. So I'm curious what their plans are going forward.
Max, great stuff. Zeke Fox, Max Chafkin, they've got this really good story. I just keep scrolling down, and there's more and more and more good stuff here. Bankman-Fried's original sin at FTX is trouble for all of crypto. For all our listeners and viewers out there that are interested in this space, go to Bloomberg.com and find this story, because it is really good reporting, some really cool stuff in there. So check it out there. Max Chafkin, he does all that stuff for Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.